This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl. My name is Lucy Smith, and this week it's one of those episodes that kind of blew my mind. In fact, I want to go back and listen to this week's episode just to get all of this information in my brain. But it's brought to you by people who can explain it so well. This week's episode, we delve into the world of physics, astrophysics, dark matter, neuroscience, and so much more with friend of the show, Professor Geraint Lewis. And you're going to meet Caitlin Thurn. It is her first time on the show. She's someone who is still studying and yet has put together some really amazing initiatives for paying it forward for the next generation of scientists. You'll learn more about that in this episode. I'm Lucy Smith. Let's do it. I've got Dr. Carl across from me in the studio right now. But Dr. Carl, we are having a full-blown party in the studio this morning.
I do love working in the School of Physics because they just search us for the truth. And so let's introduce them. Take it away.
So we got Geraint Lewis joining us. Now, Geraint, you've been on the show many times, friend of the show. You are someone who is specialising, I guess, in the worlds of physics, astrophysics, dark matter, astronomy. What is one thing you've been working on recently?
Oh, I've been working on this new sort of experiment we're trying to do to find out if the universe is broken.
Yeah, it is.
A minor question.
It's a big question everyone's looking at the moment. It might be that the universe has a preferred direction, which is something that's quite unexpected. So we're really trying to look at, is it broken or not?
Okay. Is it broken or not?
Because if it had a spin, we might be in a black hole. That was another story.
Okay.
Next person, Caitlin.
Next person, Caitlin Thurn, making your Science with Dr. Carl debut. Caitlin, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
There's a few different avenues that we can go down with you, Caitlin. So let's start with the fact that you are specialising in physics and mathematics. You're still studying. You've previously studied neuroscience at the University of Melbourne, and you founded a really special project, which we're going to get to a little bit later on.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, what is something that you've been working on amongst your studies that's really blowing your mind at the moment?
Oh, I mean, honestly, all of the physics I'm learning, I'm still a lowly second year undergrad, so nothing compared to the good Geraint here. But it's really wonderful to just start exploring the magic of how physics works and how the universe works. Doing quantum at the end of last term was beautiful because it was the first little taste of the real mathematics that underpins that understanding.
Yeah.
And getting to understand how much of it feels like absolute magic and just a statistical basis for how we understand the universe to work, rather than being the classical world one would expect to live in, where if you throw a tennis ball, it's going to do exactly what you told it to.
Yeah.
It was really fascinating and good fun to start dipping my toe into exploring that world.
Totally. And this is something that you're also applying. You are a serving member of the Australian Army Reserve as a combat engineer. Tell us about that work. What does that look like?
Yeah. I will admit it's one of my absolute joys. There's such a strong community and connection there. And it's the kind of place where you're just never alone. No matter what you need to do, no matter if it's digging holes in the rain or running up and down in circles in the bush, you're just never alone, which is really, really beautiful to see. For that role, I've been in the reserves for about 6 or 7 years now, and combat engineering boils down to three main things. It's find it, build it, or blow it up.
Wow. Rules for life as well, yes.
All the high-risk search, that all the photographs were coming out of Afghanistan, Iraq, back in the 2000s, that was all combat engineering skill set that we train in now, as well as basic construction and all the kind of supportive work. If you were to go into after a natural disaster or something, we often get pulled to help with the SES on that front in Australia as well. And then explosives is the other tool of the trade, which is just excellently good fun. Sitting in a bunker, having everything rigged up, sitting there eating snakes, waiting for them to make sure the head count's good before you hit the button and it starts, the world ends behind you. It's just very, very good fun.
And so what kind of questions would you like to answer today? What can people pick your brain about?
Well, I will admit I've got a broad kind of knowledge base from neuroscience at the University of Melbourne, now doing physics and maths at UCID, plus that military connection. Honestly, just things in understanding of how your mind works, that's something I can help people to understand a little bit better. Physics as well, I've got certainly a capability to answer questions there, although the absolute technicality, I will, of course, pass to the good Geraint. I'm happy to answer any curiosities about the military, but I will admit I am not anyone in PR for them. So
yeah.
And don't forget that you blew my mind with explaining yet again the Young Double Slit Experiment. Looked up on Wikipedia, and I still have difficulty understanding it, but thank you for taking me part of the way down.
Let's talk about that a little bit later on as well.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
We'll jump into a question here. To kick us off, Caleb on the Central Coast. Caleb, what do you want to know this morning? Got three big brains to get into it.
I've just always wondered what would happen if we let a nuclear bomb off on the moon, if it would affect Earth's gravity and tides.
Really, if you explode a nuclear bomb on the moon, it would have essentially no effect on the Earth whatsoever. We think nuclear bombs are very, very powerful, and of course they are for humans. They can destroy cities and decimate large areas, but astronomically speaking, they're actually a small amount of energy. So if you wanted to really affect the tides on the Earth, you need a lot more energy. You would need to move the moon or break the moon up, and nuclear weapons just aren't powerful enough. Sorry about
okay.
that. Did you have a plan?
No, but maybe I can come up with one.
Okay, cool.
Kayla, we got to watch out for it. Dr. Carl, anything to add there?
The Americans had a plan to explode nuclear weapons on the moon, but the amount of energy is relatively small compared to the big things that we have happening. So, for example, when the two black holes that we first saw running into each other back in 2015, a century after Einstein predicted it, when they collided, in that 1/10 of a second, apparently, they put out 50 times more power than every star in the entire universe add up, but only for 1/10 of a second.
Wow.
That is serious power. But a nuke, small yeah. time.
Thanks, Caleb.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we got Connor in Ngunnawal country. Connor, this is you've asked this in a really good way because I think it's a common sensation we don't think about. Talk us through it.
Howdy, howdy, doctors. I was with my housemates last night and we were, I don't know who brought it up, but someone mentioned if you look at a surface or an object, you can imagine what it's like to lick it or have it on your tongue, respectfully. And I'm just wondering, why is that? Why are we able to, you know, imagine textures on our tongue better than, say, our hands?
Totally, Connor. I'm looking down at this desk and I know exactly what it would be like. I'm looking at this mic sock. I know exactly what it would feel like. Caitlin, can you speak to this at all from a neuroscience perspective? Dr. Carl?
Well, I can do a little bit of a start. So it takes 3/10 of a second from when light lands on your retina to end up giving you that full 3D colour thing. And then it has to be further processed. Roughly 4% of us cannot have a visual memory. It's called aphantasia, and it was first noted by Galton, G-A-L-T-O-N, who was a cousin of Charles Darwin, when in 1906 he went to a country fair in Plymouth, and he suddenly realised that, on one hand, he worked out that the average guess for the weight of an ox was really close to, but then he started thinking, and he realised that he couldn't imagine what the ox would have looked like before it got killed. Then he went back to Oxford, and he asked his mates about it, and apparently the first 9 Oxford dons that he spoke to said, no, I can't have mental images in my head. Example of a mental image, if you think that you're on a holiday on a tropical island in the South Pacific and you're lying on the sand with your feet facing the ocean, most of us would have this image of feet, yellow sand, blue water, blue sky. None of the people he spoke to in the first thing at Oxford had that ability. 4% of the population do not. So I've warmed Caitlin up for the fact that we all differ and some of us can't get mental images, and some people would probably translate that rich tapestry coming out of the visual cortex into other parts of their body, such as their tongue. Over to you. Sorry to throw you in a deep end.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's interesting that so many of the Oxford dons came back as not being able to visualise things similarly, because it's actually something that's correlated with ADHD. It's often an indicator that if you are somebody who has ADHD traits, then you struggle with that visualization process, and it's not a way you tend to interpret things. But the way the brain works, just at the absolute most fundamental level, it's pattern recognition. So it's understanding and building from experience from the time you're born until the time you stop paying attention to the world, that the world is patterns and things get repeated. So in building that understanding of, okay, what would this feel like when I lick it, or not taste, but actually feel like, there's not so many sensations that your tongue can actually perceive. It's nowhere near as tactilely aware as your hands or your skin or anything, because that's not its major job as a sensory organ. It's, you know, the taste organ. So when you're thinking about licking something, there's just not that many different ways that you would be able to experience a surface. So there's not that many patterns to need to remember.
Ah.
Or there's not that many patterns that you need to become familiar with to be able to then understand and identify, oh, if I licked the surface of the table, it's going to feel smooth. If I lick something that's like a carpet, other than finding dog hair on my tongue, it's going to be fairly fluffy feeling. So the brain building process of identifying those variety of patterns to then be able to apply that to this with how it would feel if I licked this thing, it's just not that complex.
And just one thing I suddenly realised from working with grandchildren and little nieces, if they're under the age of one, everything goes in their mouth.
Yes.
Everything. Bridget in Newcastle, what's your question?
Hi, I was just wondering, what is dark matter and why does it matter so much?
I like that. What is dark matter and why does it matter? Who wants to start, Geraint?
I'll take that because I work on dark matter, so I know this topic. So for the last 100 years or so, astronomers have been measuring gravity in the universe, and what we keep finding is that there's a lot more gravity than we can account for from the stars that we can see. So basically, we've had to hypothesize that there's extra mass out there that we can't see, but we can feel its gravity. Why is it important? Well, it turns out there's a lot more of it than there is of the atoms of stuff that we're made of. There's a lot more of this dark matter than there is normal matter. So is it important? Well, in your day-to-day, it might not be very, very important, but for the sun, it's very important because it's what holds the sun in its orbit in the Milky Way galaxy is the dark matter. So it's dark matter is very important for holding the universe together, but the problem is we don't really know what it is. We have got lots of ideas, but we've never found any in our laboratory, so we're still looking for what is dark matter. And that might unlock some new secrets to just the way the universe works.
Interesting. Does that help, Bridget?
Yeah, that helps a lot. Thank you so much.
Fabulous. Thank you. We're going to Sydney now with Stephen, Dr. Stephen. You're going to take us into the sci-fi movie world. Talk to us.
Absolutely. I love my sci-fi movies. And there's stuff like Interstellar that do a really good job at explaining time dilation. You know, spend an hour around a black hole and it's like 7 years on Earth. But I don't understand length dilation. I watched Project Hail Mary, and the faster they got to the speed of light, the like closer the planet was. I don't get it.
This is going to warp my brain, isn't it, Geraint?
It is. Unfortunately, it's just a weird way that the universe works. So, as you mentioned, if I start flying off to the nearest star, it might take 100 years for me to get there for people here on Earth. But to myself, it might only be a couple of days for that particular journey. So you get that time dilation, as it's called. But to me on board that ship, it means that the distance to that star has contracted. It feels a lot closer. And in fact, the faster and faster I go in the universe, the closer and closer everything feels. I can get to things quicker than if I could imagine the clocks ticking back at home. So I actually had a student work on this a few years ago. If you fly off in a rocket and keep accelerating, in about 99 years to your own time, you would reach the edge of the universe as we can see it now. Billions of years would pass on Earth, but to you, it would be a long lifetime. So yeah, we do get this contraction. Everything feels closer the faster and faster we get to the speed of light.
That makes me sick.
And in fact, we've now got clocks that are so accurate that if you have an atomic clock and lift or drop it by a fraction of a millimeter, we can measure it speeding up and slowing down. I don't know what the equivalent is for length.
Caitlin, anything to add here?
I mean, I will say that as to the actual experience of that, it may be 99 years to reach the end of the universe, which is strange that it feels a vaguely achievable human time frame there. That's a really cool number to know of. But you personally, in the rocket ship going that fast, you wouldn't experience the contraction because you're contracting yourself. So that whole idea that what you experience in that moment is just kind of your normal.
And is, leads to a very devastating scene in Interstellar. No spoilers, Stephen. Thank you so much for your question.
Thanks, guys. Warps my brain. Love it.
Warps the brain. Continuing that, Francis in Epping, tell us about The Expanse. It's a TV show. What have you seen in it?
Yes. In it, the hero ship, the Rosinante, comes under fire by multiple missiles, about 15, I think, and they do a manoeuvre called a Death Blossom, where it's a sort of wobbly roll to bring all the guns on the ship to bear on the missiles to try and defend against them. Would that actually work in real life?
All right, Caitlin, do you want to try and break this down for us as best you can?
Yeah, certainly. So I think, I will admit, I'm thinking from a little bit of a more military-minded perspective here. I mean, it depends how those missiles were targeting you. If they were straight, just plug the coordinates in or tell you your angle of elevation and your velocity at launch, then absolutely, if you move out of the way, well, then you're not going to be there. So it would work to defend. If it were something more in the lines of if it was locking onto a heat signature of some kind, then doing that Death Blossom move as you described might fire the engines such that it moves the heat signature of the vessel enough that those missiles might get confused by what they're locking onto, and that would save them. The third kind of thing I can think of would be that if the cannons were facing the wrong way, if somebody's coming up behind you and you have to turn around, well, doing a little flip to really be have that element of surprise and maintain that element of surprise would definitely be an option. From a physics perspective, mostly all of that would just be really uncomfortable because the G's you're pulling to get even that vessel to be able to do that kind of maneuver quickly, you have some crack shot pilots in there to be able to withstand 12G and then lock onto a target and still have some kind of wherewithal about them without having passed out.
Right, Grant.
Well, I was just going to mention that if you look at a modern warship, they have these systems on board which are all automated because the threat is missiles these days. So they are bristling with, I think they're called Vulcans, and they basically, they have loads of them over the ship, and you just need to fill the sky with lead to take out these missiles, and it's potentially what they're doing in the Expanse as well, is you just chuck as much stuff out there as possible that you try and hit everything that's coming in.
And then, of course, there's the other point of view, which is, forget missiles, let's go for lasers. And the Chinese have already tested a megawatt laser that from the air on a drone can blow a hole through a tank. And you're thinking, hang on, a drone can only pick up fairly small things, and a megawatt laser, which is really big, is maybe the size of a container or two on the back of a semi-trailer. And this is reported in the South China Daily Post. Nice reading. And apparently what they've done is put on a drone a deformable mirror. And the mirror deforms in response to density changes in the air between the laser on the ground and the drone, and then the drone and the tank. And it modifies the beam, so you get a concentrated beam on the tank, so you can have the equivalent of a megawatt laser weighing 50 tons, just on a little drone weighing a kilogram.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. Well, Francis, does that help at least with the expense for now?
Yeah, certainly.
Would you recommend the TV show?
Oh, and the books, definitely.
Oh, okay. New recommendation. Let's go to Luke in Adelaide. Now, Luke, talk us through this hypothetical. What do you want to know?
Okay, so I read and listen to mostly a really large sci-fi series set in the 41st millennium called Warhammer. And in this absolutely disgusting, horrible future, they pretty much just run around planet to planet mining the absolute hell out of everything. That got me thinking, what would happen if we... really horrible thought, but if we made a strip mine the size of Europe and about half as deep, would the atmosphere actually contour in and take that shape, or would it still just be over the top with the general shape of the planet?
Well, it's an excellent question. So to a physicist, there's really not much difference between air and water. They're both fluids and they follow the rules of fluid dynamics. And in the same way, you can imagine if you dig a big hole in the earth that the oceans would flow in there. If you dig a hole big enough in the earth, the atmosphere would flow in there as well. So the atmosphere responds to gravity. And if there's a hole, everything will just flow in. So you could end up with the situation that all the atmosphere is in the hole and there's nothing left on the rest of the planet. So, yeah, it definitely, if you start digging big holes, you'd have to worry about the atmosphere that you've got out there.
And so eventually it would just collapse, I imagine.
You could end up with no atmosphere over the surface of the planet and everything in the hole.
Yeah, right. Awesome.
So let's hope that doesn't happen.
No, that's a horrible thought, and I wish I'd never asked.
No, let's keep it in the fiction world. Thanks so much for your question, Luke.
Thank you.
Got Professor Geraint Lewis with us, friend of the show, and for the first time, Caitlin Thurn, who is someone specialising in physics, mathematics, previously studied neuroscience, medical, what did you just say, biomedical?
Yeah, I studied neuroscience through a Bachelor of Biomedicine at the University of Melbourne.
Listen, you're doing too much. No, I'm kidding. You're doing amazing work and you're actually paying that forward as well. Tell us about the Artemis Project, not affiliated with Artemis 2, I will say, but the Artemis Project. What is that, Caitlin?
So it's a charity that I started, founded it in April of last year. So it's just ticked over to a year, which is really exciting. We do free academic support options for disadvantaged students across Sydney and New South Wales. When I first moved to Sydney, I had to make ends meet and I started tutoring myself to just have some workload to be able to afford to go to uni again and everything. And I was really struck in those lessons going to students' houses how impactful it was to be able to help somebody not only understand their content better but just feel more comfortable and confident and supported in even the opportunity to learn. And in that, I was also really struck by how inaccessible it was for disadvantaged students who arguably would have an even greater potential to be impacted there. So I started the charity. It's self-sufficient, so we pull in paying tutoring clients and we use the profits from that to fund our tutors, who are all university students themselves, to support both those advantaged students as well as paying them to support as many disadvantaged students as possible as well. So those uni kids can succeed in their studies whilst also supporting their communities and not needing to give their time away for free.
That's great. So it's cyclical.
It is.
And it's just so, you know, it is one of those things where people do have that curiosity and they do have that passion to learn, but there are just those barriers to entry, right?
Yes. It's increasingly systematic that there's just a pay to win in education because you had school catchment zones informed by where you can afford to buy a house and then your ability to pay for supports if you need them. They're very expensive. And it's just it continues when it goes to university as well, because if you're having to stack shelves for 30 hours a week, then you're not engaging with your course material anywhere near as much as somebody who doesn't have to.
Yeah.
So it's just this cyclical thing. And I really think that if we want to be, you know, spacefaring and such a wonderful potential in science and really in any kind of learning pursuit, well, then it needs to start at the groundwork. It needs to start at empowering anybody to access education, no matter their circumstances. That was the point of the company, and we've got, you know, some clients going through. It's been really, really wonderful and fun.
That's great. I want to see it go national. The Artemis Project, Caitlin Thurn, look it up online, and maybe you know someone who could benefit from this. Let's check it out. Thanks so much, Caitlin, and thank you for the work that you do.
Oh, thanks, Lucy.
You're answering our questions this morning on Triple J. McKenna in Mullumbimby, what do you want to know?
Hello. My question is, what temperature would water have to be to stay in it forever without getting hyperthermic or overheating?
So hypothermic begins around 36 degrees C and you begin to lose brain function. So if you're in the water and I'm there in a boat and I say, hey, grab my hand, that doesn't make any sense to you, even though your brain's, you're still alive. And wow. So you've lost your brain function. And at the other end of the scale, 38, 39, and you go to hyperthermia. So water transmits heat about 25 to 30 times better than air. So if it's really cold, like 15 degrees C or minus 1.8, like in the Antarctic or the Arctic, the heat floods out of your body very rapidly. If you're in a sauna and you're very hot water, it floods into your body. So if you're around 25 degrees plus or minus a bit, you're neutral. That's your skin temperature, and heat will neither flow out nor flow in, but that will change over time. Because you go in there and you haven't had a meal, and then after 15 minutes, suddenly your temperature changes a little bit in response to your glucose metabolism doing some extra stuff, et cetera, et cetera. But around 25 plus or minus is temperature neutral for you. No heat's flowing in or coming out.
Wow, thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, McKenna. We got Ian in Geelong. Now, Ian, very sorry to hear what happened to you last year. You got in a motorbike accident. What happened?
I thought I could ride a motorbike when I couldn't. So I came up at about 40 kilometres an hour. As I bounced along the road, the bitumen, I realised at this point, oh, my head hit the ground and I had a helmet on. And I realised, oh, no, the strap's loose. And everything slowed down from that point where I realised, oh, no, this is where life ends, because the next time I hit, I won't have the helmet on. And I've heard this from other people, that when they've been in serious accidents, in those few seconds that the accident happens, everything slows down. So my question is, what is the brain doing to slow down thought in those moments?
So true, Ian. It's like the saying, a slow-moving train wreck or car crash. Yeah. Caitlin, can you speak to that at all?
Yeah. It's certainly something that I worry about myself. I mean, I've ridden bikes myself for years as well. And it's essentially a preservation technique for your brain. It's something goes wrong, your heart starts going, everything starts pounding faster, you know, your head gets sweaty and your brain's at the back of your head. And it's the adrenaline coming up from your brain having that stress response. And part of the effect of that adrenaline, other than the fact that everything gets faster and you get hotter and you have that fight or flight, ready to run, ready to fight response, it also means that your brain's firing faster. Mm. So your ability to kind of have thoughts and produce those neuronal patterns that lead to your thinking, as well as your ability to process that information that's coming in, speeds up. So everything gets faster in the brain as you get scared and ready to fight or ready to run or ready to just tuck and roll in the case of a motorbike accident. So that's what's informing how the world seems to slow down, because your processing of it gets faster.
And then we've actually looked at parts of the brain. And so, for example, the amygdala and the hippocampus, they do a more thorough encoding of the sensory information that's coming in, rather than saying, yeah, I'm walking down the street and there's a car on my right. And then you also have the stress hormones pushing different parts of your brain into that activity. And there's also this plain old, I'm really focusing on this thing happening. And we've got a fairly strong theoretical background as to why it should be feel like you're processing faster. But when you actually do the experiment, and it's not a very good experiment, it doesn't go faster. The experiment was, you push somebody off a building and, there was a lot of cardboard and stuff at the bottom, and there were people who were trained as stunt actors in Hollywood, and I got a few non-stunties as well, and they'd push them off a building and there'd be a whole bunch of cardboard boxes, and they had a watch, and they just sped the watch up. It was a digital display, and they just tweaked the digital display so it was rolling through the numbers just a fraction too fast for them to see the numbers clearly.
Oh.
So it was just a blur. And the thinking was, if they're really processing the data faster, they should be able to see the individual numbers. And on this small sample size, which wasn't repeated again, that was the only one I could find, it didn't go faster.
Oh.
But I'm kind of thinking it would. Like, Grant, you were mentioning a car incident with you and your family.
Yeah, I got caught up in a sort of multi-car crash in the US. Cars around me crashing, and there was one car careening towards us. And when it stopped just next to us, I turned to my wife and I just said to her, that felt like half an hour. And it was a fraction of a second, I'm sure. But it felt like forever seeing this car come in towards us in slow motion.
Insane. Ian, I hope you're all good.
Five fractured ribs and a fractured shoulder blade.
Thanks for your question.
I think it's better.
We got Jamie in Meanjin, Brisbane. Jamie, what do you want to know?
Hi, I wanted to know if rogue planets can travel through galaxies. So if it left the Milky Way, could it end up in Andromeda?
That's an excellent question. It's actually kind of hard to get stuff out of a galaxy. So we actually do see some stars that we know are escaping. They're traveling at a few thousand kilometers per second. And we think that they've come from the galactic center, where they've interacted with the supermassive black hole there. So if you have just a rogue planet on its own, it's very hard for it to escape a galaxy unless you do something dramatic. And what's going to happen in about 4 billion years is that Andromeda and the Milky Way are going to collide. And in that collision, the Milky Way is going to be seriously upset and essentially torn apart. And in that scenario, it's estimated that 10% of all the stars and planets will be ejected into intergalactic space. And so these events have happened over the history of the universe. And so there must be rogue planets in between the between the galaxies. If they're with their host star, they probably are okay. But if they are away from their host star, they're probably frozen by now.
So you're talking a couple of billion years in the future. So you said that 10% of the stars will come close enough to interact gravitationally so that one of them gets whipped out? Is that common?
No. So it's the entire action of the galaxies interacting. That big chunks of the galaxy will be ripped off and thrown.
Oh, chunks.
Out. Yes.
As opposed to individual stars.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Interesting. Hayley from Mianjin, Brisbane, what do you want to know?
Hi, doctors. My question is, why do pregnant women get brain fog or become forgetful? I'm currently 5 months pregnant and I tend to forget the silliest things. And even had to write this question down, honestly, to remember it.
Hayley, I love the commitment. Thank you.
It is real in some people, stronger in some people than the other. My wife and I were playing tennis, getting tennis lessons, and we got a phone call saying, look, you might want to write us a different check. $25,000 is more than we normally charge for a tennis lesson. There's a whole bunch of things going on, the hormone changes, the sleep disruption, the stress and the mood changes, the physical discomfort, the fatigue, and also the hormones and the chemicals in your body are changing. The baby has changed your immune system and blood flow has changed. All of these combine in different ways. It can vary, some people more than the others.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Hayley. Good luck. We got James in Listerfield. James, what do you want to know?
Okay, this is about time travel. How far off time travel are we as a species? And if we can't build it yet, should we build a receiver so that people in the future can travel back to us?
James, big moves. Professor Grant Lewis, what do you reckon?
Well, the honest answer is we don't know. When I work with relativity, I see that time travel is not ruled out by the equations, but we just do not know how we could make it work. So it might be a smart kid gets up tomorrow and has the right idea and we've got time travel, or it may never happen. So it's not ruled out, but we just do not know how to really make it work.
And what do you think about this receiver concept? What are you...
Well, what kind of receiver would we build? I mean, we said we do not know how it would actually operate, so we wouldn't know what kind of receiver. I mean, what we should do, of course, is just set up a reception room and have a party ready, and then... You know, when they arrive, we can welcome them.
Yeah, be like, hey, and don't come back here. Don't come back to this time period. James, thanks for your question.
Love it. Thank you.
And we got Pippa on the Southern Highlands. Now, Pippa, what have you been doing when you're wandering off to sleep? What's going on?
I hope I can ask this so it makes sense. So talking in my daughter last night, we were chatting, lights off, and I'm rubbing her back and I've got my eyes closed. And we were in the middle of a conversation, but as I fell asleep myself, I started to blurt out things I was dreaming. And she's sort of looking at me going, Mum, what? And, yeah, I do it quite often. As I'm falling asleep, I accidentally say the things that obviously I'm dreaming about. So I'm just wondering why that's happening.
Yeah, so it's really interesting when we sleep because so many things get turned off when you're asleep. Obviously, if you go start sprinting in your dream, and ideally if you start yelling in your dream, it doesn't happen in real life or in the room. But just as you're falling asleep, those things don't get turned off all in one hit. So they get turned off slowly and in order. So as you're drifting off, you're kind of, the speech is one of the things that gets turned off towards the end of the stack. So if you were having that conversation, you might still be having that conversation. So that's pretty well why.
Cool. Yeah, the poor darling. I started talking about apples falling a tree and she was very confused.
She's like, what are you talking about? Pippa, thank you so much for your question.
Thank you.
And that wraps this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl, a total bonanza. Caitlin Thurn, thank you so much for coming through. Your first ever episode, you smashed it.
Oh, thank you.
And we can learn more about your work through the Artemis Project online. Professor Geraint Lewis, you've got a book coming out very soon. We'll have to get you on the show in June when that's coming up.
Absolutely. The Shortest History of Reality. So I think it's a cool book.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Carl. We'll do this again next week.
Peachy keen.
So much information to dissect. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. A big thank you again to Professor Geraint Lewis and Caitlin Thurn for coming through. We have some amazing guests booked in on the Science with Dr. Carl schedule. Next week, Dr. Teresa Larkin will be back. She is someone who is an expert in all things the human body. So get your questions ready for that. You can send them in live next week on the Triple J text line Or you can get your question in early via our new form. It's in the show notes. All you have to do is tell us who you are, where you're from, and what your question is for Science with Dr. Carl. We'll give you a ring and you can join us for an upcoming episode. My name is Lucy Smith. This episode was produced by Josh Brennan, and we'll catch you next week. See ya.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.